of a deal with the Taliban, largely on the terms and condition of the militants, something which many in the U.S. believe is a surrender deal.
On Afghanistan, we have almost similar views. Iran wants peace and stability in Afghanistan, so do we. We have decided to have more frequent discussions on Afghan situation.
A
few weeks back, Donald Trump said that the U.S. forces are going to withdraw, even they will have the Christmas in America. They are that much in rush. But, you know, after the, Democratic government, when they come into power in January, so I think they have a fear of change in the policies. This is the most important subject which foreign minister of Iran and the Pakistani authorities discuss.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the hideouts of the Daesh militants in Afghanistan, which they fear may be harder to dismantle if the peace deal derails. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Clerics from major monotheistic religions gathered here in Tehran for an important goal: to promote peace based on religious commonalities. Delegates representing Islam, Christianity, and Judaism unanimously agreed that the root cause of intolerance and extremism lies in the lack of dialogue among religious leaders.
The divine books of Christianity and Judaism both speak highly of the last prophet named Muhammad. The Holy Quran has a special chapter about Saint Mary and Moses, so religions don't have any issues with each other. Therefore, it is upon us scholars to raise awareness and enlighten the minds of our people to respect other religions.
This session comes against the backdrop of repeated acts of blasphemy in France against the sectaries of Muslims. Scholars slammed the French government for lending its support to the growing anti-Islamic rhetoric in the country. This as President Emmanuel Macron argues that he seeks to promote freedom of speech. These people say freedom of expression is praiseworthy, as long as it does not contradict the right to freedom of religion.
What the French president says is merely based on his deeply entrenched racist mentality. His comments on Islam have nothing to do with free speech. His actions are aimed at spreading Islamophobia to further marginalize Muslims. Now you tell me, is this freedom of speech or is it suppression of Muslims' right to a free religion?
Iran is home to different religious minorities, from Christians and Jews to Zoroastrians. All are represented in the parliament. Scholars believe peaceful coexistence among religions hinges on a collective effort by religious leaders to sit and talk based on their commonalities.
Representatives of different religions here say what the French president describes as freedom of speech is in fact freedom of hate speech, not only against the sanctities of Muslims, but against all monotheistic religions, since they believe in the same God and honor each other's prophets. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's oil minister says the latest wave of sanctions imposed by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump, which targets the Islamic Republic's oil sector, has no practical effect and stems from Washington's grudge against Tehran. The U.S. administration imposed a fresh round of sanctions on a number of Iranian individuals and entities affiliated with the Islamic Republic's oil sector, including Minister of Petroleum Bijan Zangane. In its statement, the U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions targeted eight officials and entities, as well as the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, and the National Iranian Tanker Company, NITC. The companies of Madanipur, Mobin Holding Limited, and Oman Fuel Trading LTD were also blacklisted.
If they have any proof that I'm working with IRGC, they need to show me. If they have any proof that I'm working with the PDVSA of Venezuela, they need to show me. If they are respecting their rule and their court, they need to respect and give back the property.
Incoming reports show that Trump plans to impose a flood of new sanctions against Iran, but the Iranian oil minister Zangane says they have sanctioned whatever exists, and that the only thing left for Washington to sanction is probably the services sector.
We have plenty of oil resources, and we want to work with all the people of the world. We are friends with all the people in the region, and they are helping us, and they are They are working with us. And if America want to sanction, it doesn't change anything at all.
Tehran believes the era of unilateralism is over in the world and that Iran's oil industry will not be hamstrung. Robert O'Brien, U.S. President Donald Trump's national security advisor, has recently said that the U.S. has imposed so many sanctions on Iran that, quote, there is very little left for us to do, unquote. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister says Washington needs to kick the habit of sanctions because it gets nowhere. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
After the deal was announced, people flooded the streets of Azerbaijan's capital to celebrate the end of the conflict and the gains made. Via the deal, Baku will hold on to areas of Nagorno-Karabakh that it took during the conflict, including the enclave's second city of Shusha, and between now and December 1st, ethnic Armenian forces must give up control of a slew of other territories.
I bow down in front of the families and mothers of the martyrs. We rejoice today at the cost of their children's blood. I bow down to them. That's all I can say.
However, over in Armenia, there is no jubilation. Protesters have stormed the parliament, branding the prime minister a traitor and calling for him to resign. Although the leadership of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave says 1,200 of its defense forces have been killed and the main city of Stepanakert would have been lost within days if the fighting had continued, some say victory was possible. Armenia's prime minister says the deal was unbelievably painful but unavoidable.
Under the circumstances, making a different decision wasn't possible. I plan to give more details why it wasn't and tell everyone the reason behind last month's events. I can't do it right now for one simple reason, because we are in the process of stopping military action right now, and if I say something, I might endanger people.
Keeping a close eye on the conflict throughout, Iran, which shares borders with the disputed region, called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict that respected international law and the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the arrangement will pave the way for a lasting political settlement. For now, the battle is over, and thousands of people will now be left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States has not been so divided in recent memory as there are two people claiming to be president. The mainstream media rushed to accept Joe Biden's declaration of victory, even though he has an average lead of only 32,000 votes in three states in a vote which is not even finished counting yet. Donald Trump has also claimed victory prematurely. It appears half the country believes Biden is the president-elect, while the other half believes Trump is the president-elect. No one knows what will happen next, and many fear tensions could elevate into violence.
Joe Biden has won. Trump may contest it, but the evidence is there. There is no illegal things regarding vote. The system has worked, and it will continue. One man will not ruin this system for us. Joe Biden is now our president.
And one thing I want to add, it's not Republican versus Democrat. Yes. We are Americans.
America special about our country.
Period.
But mail-in ballots were used in unprecedentedly massive numbers, and the vote's legality has been openly disputed for many months. It seems certain the courts will ultimately decide the legality of the vote, and maybe even who won, as in the year 2000, which caused massive political alienation, cultural division, and mistrust. The lack of trust is also because the U.S. election process is considered the worst of any of the core Western democracies. That's according to the Harvard-based Electoral Integrity Project, whose 2019 index ranked U.S. elections just 57th in the world. Pro-Biden corporate media is seemingly acting as if there is no dispute at all, while skeptical pro-Trump outlets insist this unique election must be vetted by the courts, and that Trump must not concede before that process is finished.
I think he'll just give it up eventually. People will stop giving him airtime, stop giving him attention, and he'll just give up. He'll figure out another way to be in the news and all over the place.
Both sides appear to be bewildered by the stance of the other side, and both sides are certain of their own righteousness. With two presidents, many say the U.S. election could not have turned out worse, and the worst seems yet to come. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. In a statement, Abbas said he looks forward to working with the President-elect and his administration. Palestinian officials have expressed their satisfaction with the departure of outgoing President Donald Trump and said for them nothing was worse than Trump's era.
We welcome the results of the American elections. Like many world states, we agree that Trump's era was a nightmare. As President Abbas said, we are looking forward to achieve freedom, independence, justice, and dignity for our people. All previous U.S. administrations had specific commitments towards Israel, but this time we hope we can cooperate with the new administration.
Several Palestinian political groups have also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump. The man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration.
We don't expect to witness a great difference between U.S. administrations and the Israeli regime. But Trump tarnished U.S. image and harmed its interests in the region. I hope Biden can make the U.S. committed to international law. Biden and Trump differ in everything, in performance and reasoning.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden. But at the same time, he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level. For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020. By Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the Sacred Defense. A new model for the presence of the people in the arena of Sacred Defense and the cultivation of talents.
The third point is that during the Sacred Defense, a new model was presented for popular presence. The way the people participated was extraordinary, and on the basis of that presence, talents were cultivated. I will provide brief explanations for each. First of all the people of Iran, everyone who was willing to participate in that arena, managed to find their place through a lively, efficient, volunteer-based, and enthusiastic network. For example, a 14-year-old soldier who had joined the front lines by tampering with their identification card knew where his place was. He could find his place in order not to be idle. For example, he was charged with bringing water, sending messages as a courier, and other such duties.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger among
others. Lord, anyone in Krami, Sayyidul Akwani, Huwal Manna.
The same was true of a 70-year-old man who had joined the front lines. He too would be able to find his role. It was completely clear what role an old man would fulfill, and thus no one would remain idle. Neither that 13-year-old boy nor that 70-year-old man would remain idle. As for 8, 9, 10-year-old girls at school who wished to have a share in that endeavor, they too would find their place. They would embark on writing letters to unknown soldiers, and they would send the letters by putting them inside food packages and other popular gifts. It happened frequently that when soldiers in the front lines opened food packages, they would find these letters in which a 7, 8, 10-year-old girl had written, "Dear brother in the army, you are struggling hard. I pray for you." And so on and so forth. In other words, a little girl was also able to participate. Honorable ladies too could provide supplies for the front lines with their sewing machine, their food, their jams, their pickles, their bread, and doing the laundry.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Number three.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate with me, Gisumisha Ahmadi. Pakistani and Indian troops have clashed in disputed Kashmir, leaving at least 15 people dead, including one Pakistani and four Indian soldiers. Many more have also been wounded on both sides of the border. Now, this comes as tensions are running high between two nuclear-armed neighbors. In this edition of The Debate, we will take a closer look at the long-running dispute over Kashmir and its grave future risks for the region and beyond. Let's get some more updates from our correspondent, Shahana Butt, who's joining us live from Kashmir. Can you please tell us more about this recent incident?
Actually, India and Pakistan border skirmishes are not new when it comes to the disputes across the globe. So in 2003, India and Pakistan had signed an agreement on which the two countries agreed to hold their fire so that human casualties and human lives will be saved, as human lives matter. But unfortunately, since the agreement was signed, the agreement has never been adhered. And each year, Kashmir witnesses casualties on the borders. People have to flee their homes. They do not settle down at one place, especially those who live on the borders. So again, this year, at least the skirmishes were a little less compared to the past. But now, since this year is towards the end, today's incident has had a great human toll, as we can see that on the two sides, around 10 civilians have died and around 5 security personnel, again, human lives lost on both sides. So the tensions continue in the region and they've never stopped. And the border skirmishes have resulted in a constant fear among people living on the borders because they have no place to go. And all of a sudden, the tensions rise between the two countries, and all of a sudden, bombardment starts and artillery is being used, weapons are being used, mortars are being used. And also, more than 20 people have been injured in today's incident. And even now, the two sides have not stopped. There has not been any cap to the violation of ceasefire. Despite the presence of United Nations military observers group on both sides of line of control, the tensions continue, and the United Nations military observers group has not just failed any other organization, but people of Kashmir itself, because people of Kashmir have been long demanding the resolution of the matter in a full-fledged manner in order to avoid more loss of lives, because over the years Kashmir has witnessed a lot of turbulence and violence when it comes to the political sphere and when it comes to the border tensions between India and Pakistan. The two countries have never reached a negotiation table. They've not agreed to resolve the matter. And today, the issue of Kashmir has reached a complex point where not just India and Pakistan are talking about a dispute, but here China has also come into the dispute. So it is now not just a bilateral dispute that India and Pakistan used to talk. It has become a trilateral issue. And also people of Kashmir do want to participate whenever the issue will be discussed. So the tensions between the two countries have mounted again. And as you can see, the civilian casualties. New Delhi says that it is a bid from Pakistan's side to pump in infiltrators into the Indian side. Pakistan, however, denies the accusations. And this blame game goes on and on and on. And it has continued for the past 70 plus years. And the ultimate loss is of the people of Kashmir, who die on every front each day. So here comes the role of international community, who can actually help people of Kashmir live peacefully and get the matter resolved between India, Pakistan and all the stakeholders, especially people of Kashmir. And this is what the people of Kashmir want, that resolution involving the people of Kashmir that was promised at the time of the accession of Kashmir with India. So high time for the two countries and global leaders to resolve the matter peacefully and amicably before it turns out to be a nuclear war where there is no end to devastation, disaster and mourning.
Thank you very much, our correspondent Shahana Butt, live from Kashmir. Now, to elaborate more on that situation, get more details, we're joined by a former Pakistani senior diplomat, Jamil Khan, who is joining us live from Toronto. Now, Mr. Khan, India says that Pakistan initiated the unprovoked ceasefire violation, while Pakistan is also accusing India of the same thing. Who is telling the truth?
It's not the first time. And this year, I think it's over 1,700 LOC violation has taken place, and there have been death toll on Pakistani side, more than what the Indians claim, reportedly. But then that's the issue which can never be resolved if this problem goes on. And this, as has been discussed earlier before me, that it is a flashpoint. My Prime Minister of Pakistan also has indicated, not at one occasion, including Security Council General Assembly session last year, he did indicate that how important it is that the two nuclear armed countries, they are just eyeball to eyeball. And it's not going to really just affect these two countries. And I'm going to come on the international law and how what the international community is required to do, and they are obliged to do according to the resolutions already passed of the Security Council, so that the region is in peace and the people of the region, particularly Jammu and Kashmir, they are able to live their peaceful life according to the human rights and according to the all the international law. So coming back on that point, that this flashpoint, Prime Minister Imran Khan also indicates that Bill Clinton in his tenure had also mentioned that this is this line of control and this skirmishes and the dispute and the conflict between India and Pakistan, particularly because of the line of control. This is the most dangerous situation of the world. That's what Bill Clinton said. And several think tanks and leaders of the world, they recognize. Unfortunately, they feel that before that stage arrives, the world leaders and the Security Council and perhaps the other powerful members of the Security Council would probably be able to control the situation. But the history of war is very clear demonstration, very clear testimony that it doesn't happen once the war starts. So, A, that both sides are suffering casualties. B, that it's Pakistan troops that they are handicapped, because on that side of Pakistan also they are the same community living in there, particularly same faith, Muslims, and this side. So they normally, Pakistan side has a handicap, and they take a major response. They give a major response only to target the bunkers and all, and in the process sometimes collateral damage, which is basically exploiting them. Let me also tell you the very trick in it. India sometimes initiates this kind of problem because they expect some fire, and then they start blaming Pakistan about the cross border, and they start telling the government, the community of the world, that is Pakistan which is fired. So this probably riffraff would going on if we only have in our mind the Security Council resolutions, which are about 12 Security Council resolutions, and if initial three Security Council resolutions which were passed, if they are implemented by the world community, by the world organization, that's the United Nations, this problem would no longer be there. But the problem is, instead of blaming each other, the Indians, particularly this regime of Modi, is further aggravating it. Now, according to the Geneva Convention and according to the Geneva Convention for Article 49, the abrogation of the Constitution 370 and Article 35 of Indian Constitution, that's against those international law, against the Security Council resolution, in which it says that you cannot bring people from outside of that territory and start settling it down. 1.2 million domicile certificates, means the residence certificate, has been issued against the very characteristic of the whole law. So this even attracts the war crime, which is the Article 8 of the war crime, and it attracts that. So from those international point of view, I would say the international law should be respected, and the international community should intervene. I don't think bilaterally India is willing to resolve this problem. Otherwise,
I'm very sorry I'm cutting you off. We're also joined by a professor of international relations from the University of Westminster, Mr. Debyesh Anand from London, and we would like to also hear from him. Professor, if you could please tell us why India and Pakistan are at odds over Kashmir in the first place.
Thanks for having me here. As your initial reporter from ground level in Srinagar and Kashmir pointed out, that India and Pakistan have been struggling over Kashmir. And of course, we usually see it in terms of proprietorial dispute. That's a territorial dispute between India and Pakistan over who should own the entire state of Jammu and Kashmir, right? And that's the ownership part. And the sad part is what the diplomat earlier was talking about, and he did rightly point out that what the Hindu national government in India is doing is war crime. What's happening in terms of Indian occupied Kashmir is draconian laws and denial of rights to people. That's all happening. But the fact of the matter is, Pakistan has not been very different in that context. And I just found it quite disturbing, I have to say, when the diplomat said that the Pakistani military is in a way more tempered, more measured, because on the other side, Muslims live. I mean, what kind of states are we talking of where the whether you shoot or not, whether you kill or not, depends upon whether you're Muslim or Hindu or whatever. But the sad reality is this is what's happening vis-a-vis India and Pakistan. Both of them claim Jammu and Kashmir. Both of them occupy parts of Jammu and Kashmir. Of course, China is also another actor. And both of them play a game. And the sad part, again, as I keep saying sad because it is a tragic story, is who died today? It's essentially soldiers of India, soldiers of Pakistan. And these soldiers are generally from poor families. Who dies? Occasionally officers. Who dies? Civilians of Kashmir who have never been given right by either India and Pakistan to decide for themselves whether they want India, Pakistan, or independence from both, right? On that matter, when do we find generals, politicians, diplomats, and news anchors ever dying in these wars? And this is what we are dealing with. We are dealing with two states that claim to be post-colonial, but are colonizing people and do not allow people there to exercise their right to self-determination. And that's the real tragedy of this.
Thank you very much. Now back to our guest in Toronto, Mr. Khan. Why has this long-running conflict defied any kind of solution?
Our solution, because solution is not in the hands of these two countries. We tried. Both these countries, they tried entering into a Shimla Accord. And the Shimla Accord, they were hoping that bilaterally they should be able to resolve their problem. But their time and in history has shown that none of the leaders on both sides from in past so many years that they've been able to resolve it. Rather, it further aggravates. So the only solution to my understanding and to my analysis is that it's the multilateral solution, because the entire world would get affected. It's not only the two part of this very region and this very continent, but the entire world is going to be affected because of the lethality of both the countries. They are armed to it to its teeth, and that to nuclear arm. And let me tell you just about 30 seconds about the technical aspect of any flashpoint anywhere in the world. If the nuclear flashpoint takes place, there are about 50 kilometers the smoke or the dust, the radioactive particles, they go into the air and they affect the entire world within 7 days. So I guess the world leader sooner or later would realize they only are under the complacency that probably that stage, before that stage arises, they will step in. One more point I want to add, one of your guests was indicating, and that point is about a military observer. And India here cannot give any justification as to why they do not accord the access to the military observers in their territory. They are always, ever since they were established in 1949 onward, they are always there on the side of the Pakistani territory, and the India never allows them. So if they are gone there, if they go there, I have also worked in the United Nations, at least they would be able to give a neutral account of the incidents which take place, and which I do agree with your guest that this both sides are the human beings. It so happens that they are from one faith or one community on both sides, but then these are somehow factored into the skirmishes and war. And they are, as a matter of fact, if I'm the proponent of the human rights, and I am the proponent of the respect to the human lives, basically. So therefore, unless we are able to respect those international law, and if there is any problem, the Security Council should get together and they should invoke the United Nations Charter of 34. And according to United Nations Charter 34, even for this incident we are discussing, they can in a meeting decide to investigate it, so that the countries, they try and refrain from entering into this riffraff and entering into this blame game and entering into escalation of the whole thing, because that is going to lead us to nowhere. And therefore, it's very important that the international law should be respected.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khan. Since you mentioned escalation, that is our next question. Mr. Anand, how likely is this conflict to turn into something serious?
Well, with India and Pakistan, it's always a trigger point. And we have to understand that the Indian government at this point is a Hindu nationalist far-right government that seems to like war, that seems to like conflict, and they feel that Pakistan is a country they can bully. That's one. And second, I mean, we also know that whatever the top government leaders decide, be it on Pakistan side or India side, they cannot always control the narrative on the border. So in my view, at this point in time, given that India is already having tension with China on the border, it's not likely to be in India's interest to increase the border's tension beyond a certain point. But they keep the tensions on, and I have been to one side of the border, and I would like to go to the other side of the border, but I have to say this, that until, and as I agree with the diplomat earlier, when he said that, look, human beings exist on both sides, but we also need to go beyond this whole idea of what identity do they have in terms of religious identity. The reality is, international law is partly a solution, but please remember, in a way, Holocaust was legal according to the Germans. Genocide is often legal, colonization was legal, so law is not the answer here. What's the answer is when we recognize that the main people who are the stakeholders here are neither India nor Pakistan. It is people of Jammu and Kashmir. And until and unless we highlight their right to self-determination, and UN resolution is good to talk about, but we do know, we have seen what happens with it. I mean, do we really think that UN Security Council, which has China on one side vis-a-vis Pakistan and US and UK and France on the other side, are they really going to do anything about India and Pakistan? No, they don't care. The only talk about is these countries should, so long as maintain peace. Frankly, the peace of the international community is peace of Israel and Palestine, which is essentially a control. So what I would say is, what we need to do is we need to highlight the human story here. We need to highlight that the most important people are Kashmiris. And we need to highlight that until unless there's a genuine democratization in India and Pakistan, I mean, using the word genuine democratization, because India is facing a possibility of Hindu fascism, and of course Pakistan has a serious role where there's a so-called establishment is essentially a military state, right? So until unless there's a genuine democratization in both India and Pakistan, and there's Azadi for Kashmiris, which is freedom for Kashmiris, the solution would not be found, right? So solution, and there is a simple solution. Both India and Pakistan should withdraw from there. Both India and Pakistan should allow all, remember, it's not only Muslims. I'm sorry, the diplomat was. People on both sides are Muslims. They are Sikhs. They are Hindus. They are other religious communities. So religion, in a way, that does not is not the most important factor. Most important factor is people of the region should be allowed to live, breathe, with dignity, and they should be allowed the right to self-determination, which includes India, Pakistan, according to UN resolution, but it has to go beyond it to also include freedom from both. Until unless that happens, I'm afraid we'll be seeing a repetition of these deaths and murders again and again.
Thank you very much. We don't have much time left, so Mr. Khan, if you could please wrap this up. Our other guest from London did mention something very interesting, that law may not be exactly the best solution here. So do you agree with that statement?
No, whatever has been said, ideally, yes. But last 70 years, we have not been able to reach to any solution. So what happens if someone doesn't follow the law? Then obviously the implementer of law, they come and try to implement the law. Now, if the military observers are not accepted, and that's an international law by the India, and if the resolution is not accepted, Pakistan has said several times that let's go for the plebiscite. So plebiscite is not accepted to them. And I totally agree with your guest in London, that Mr. Anand, that yes, they should be given their right of self-determination. This is what the international law also says. This is what I have quoted already about the Geneva Convention, Article 49. And therefore, that is, there is true. But who is going to really, both sides, yes, should have a democratic government. Both sides should have the best of the best leadership. But who is going to bring it down to there? 70 years we have tried. And if it's not being there, if it's not happening, then world, and he's right, he's very right. The regional politics is also another group. And because of that regional politics, which is the CPAC, which is the BRI, and which is the opposition by the bloc made by US, and US making India as a watchdog of the entire area. And you have seen recently how many agreements have really taken place between the two countries. So this is going to further complicate the situation. It may be because of the China, or maybe because human beings and the people inhabitant in that area, they are going to suffer. And unfortunately, without the international law implementation, I don't find any solution. I don't see that in the years to come, we'll have these ideal situations where both the countries are going to sit together and going to resolve their problem bilaterally. It didn't happen 70 years, and it doesn't seem to happen in the next several more years.
Can I just add something in 10 seconds?
Yes, please, go ahead.
I agree with it. Of course, international community's pressure has to be there, but that's not realistic given the power dynamics that's taking place. What's even equally important is equally important is mobilization of people, progressive, and anyone who opposes human rights abuse, both in India and Pakistan, and holding the states accountable and saying enough is enough. Let Kashmir be free. Let Kashmir be other.
Thank you very much, Professor. Yes, Mr. Khan.
Human Rights Commission should be implemented and this point would be addressed. That's right.
Thank you very much. Professor of International Relations, University of Westminster, Dibyash Anand, joining us live from London, and former Pakistani senior diplomat Jamil Khan from Toronto. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for taking part in this edition of The Debate, and thanks for following us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United States on Monday, November 9th, faced criticism over its human rights record from allies and adversaries alike at the United Nations as the country submitted to its first universal periodic review of the Trump administration. According to Agence France-Presse, the concern raised most at the half-day event was police violence against black people and other minorities and in response to racial justice protests. U.S. policies and actions abroad, including the continued operation of the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the never-ending so-called war on terror, were also discussed. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading From Police Violence at Home to Killing Civilians in Unending Wars Abroad, U.S. Faces Human Rights Reckoning at United Nations. Here's the details of this article. The United States on Monday, November 9th, faced criticism over its human rights record from allies and adversaries alike at the United Nations as the country submitted to its first universal periodic review of the Trump administration. All 193 UN member states must undergo UPRs, which are held at the United Nations Human Rights Council, HRC, from which the U.S. withdrew in 2018, over alleged anti-Israel bias in Geneva, Switzerland, every 5 years. Some 120 nations participated in this year's debate, which mostly occurred online due to the coronavirus pandemic, about the U.S. human rights record. Many nations, some with their own serious rights issues, offered criticism ranging from constructive to condemnatory. Country representatives were allowed less than a minute each to comment on the subject. According to Agence France-Presse, the concern raised most at the half-day event was police violence against black people and other minorities and in response to racial justice protests. U.S. policies and actions abroad, including the continued operation of the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the never-ending so-called war on terror, were also discussed. U.S. allies urged Washington to ratify human rights treaties while expressing alarm over racism, inequality, gun violence, family separation, and other abuse of undocumented migrants and additional social ills, the Associated Press reports. Australia and the Netherlands were among the friendly nations that called upon the U.S. to enact a moratorium on the death penalty. Germany asked the United States to join the HRC and to end its sanctions against International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, who infuriated President Donald Trump and other U.S. leaders when she announced the ICC was launching an investigation of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. Rival nations did not pull any punches in their criticism of U.S. human rights violations both at home and abroad. Among these were systematic racism, politicization of the COVID-19 pandemic, gun proliferation, and unending imperialist wars that have killed at least hundreds of thousands of civilians in more than half a dozen nations over the past 19 years. Stop interfering for political reasons in other countries' internal affairs under the pretext of human rights, Chinese Representative Jiang Duan admonished. Pushing back against the global criticism, U.S. Ambassador Andrew Bremberg said that the American democratic system allows for continued scrutiny, advocacy, and debate, which fuels progress and reform. We're willing to openly acknowledge our shortcomings, Bremberg insisted. While this was the first UPR of Trump's tenure, the HRC conducted a six-month investigation in 2017 and 2018, resulting in a report condemning the administration for consciously exacerbating the worst economic inequality in the developed world. In July 2020, the HRC also decried the arbitrary arrest and detention and unnecessary, disproportionate, or discriminatory use of force against protesters, journalists, and others at demonstrations following the police and white supremacist killings of Black and Latino people, including George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, Tony McDade, Anders Guardado, and others. Human rights groups welcomed the UPR. Today, the world watches to see whether the United States will seize the opportunity for its policies to be examined fully under the light of transparency, or whether it will shirk from the sunlight and bury its human rights record in the shadows of excuses. Bob Goodfellow, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, said in a statement. ACLU Human Rights Director Jamil Dagwa responded to the UPR by urging Joe Biden to prioritize re-engagement with international human rights. While the American voters elected the new president, the international community must continue to hold the U.S. accountable to its international human rights obligations, Dagwa said, adding that the UN should ensure that the U.S. repair the damages caused to millions of people's lives over the past 4 years.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.